thank you for agreeing to be part of my experiment. It's very difficult to get research subjects in my field.
I'm still not 100% clear about what this field is.
Well, you know, I don't really like to say it.
I think you have to.
Okay. Well, I'm looking at what happens if people, you know, if people make sexy time.
If people make sexy time. People do make sexy time. Right now, there are millions of people all over the world making sexy time.
They don't. That is crazy talk. Why? Have you heard something?
I don't have to hear something. I mean, how do you think babies are made?
Oh, I know that. The woman has a shrimp cocktail and 4 glasses of Chardonnay. My mother explained the whole thing to me. She lived through it.
Look, you seem nice, but I think you're ill-equipped to conduct sex research.
What's that supposed to mean? I have binoculars, a stopwatch, and a bucket of cold water. What else is there?
Everything.
Maybe I should listen to this show about a famous researcher whose work spanned decades and created controversies. And now the man who made Norman Mailer stop touching himself, Colin McEnroe.
I wouldn't say I did that. I got him to cut back quite a bit. We had some very serious conversations about that. And I do think I made an impact anyway. We're going to talk today about Wilhelm Reich. Wilhelm Reich is somebody that you know about if you've studied the history of psychoanalysis, the stories of the early disciples of Freud. He's also this man who had this tremendous impact. He crossed paths with just about every major thinker of the 20th century, from Bronislaw Malinowski to Albert Einstein. His work, or at least parts of his work, attracted the excitement of people like J.D. Salinger, Saul Bellow. In fact, yes, Norman Mailer. Musicians write songs about him. There's a Patti Smith song about him and his son. You'll hear later a Kate Bush song about one of his inventions. He's somebody who's commemorated in all kinds of different ways, but he also was one of the most persecuted men of the 20th century. He is, I don't know if he's unique, but he's unusual at least in having had his work, his books, and his other work burned in Nazi Germany, from which he fled, and then after fleeing to America, later had his books and work burned in America. I'm not sure how many people can claim that dubious distinction. So he also has a number of supporters, people who feel as though there are parts of his work that have been lost in the shuffle of controversy, and we have two of them here today. Kevin Hinchey is here. He's co-director of the Wilhelm Reich Infant Trust and operates the Wilhelm Reich Museum in Rangeland, Maine, up by those beautiful lakes. He's also a screenwriter who is currently working on a documentary about Wilhelm Reich. We'll tell you a little bit, too, about how he's seeking funding. There's an Indiegogo campaign right now. We'll tell you about that later on. Also joining us, James Strick, a professor and chair of the Department of Science, Technology, and Society, professor of Earth and Environment at Franklin and Marshall College. He's the author of Wilhelm Reich, Biologist, which is published by Harvard University Press. And, you know, James Strick, I might just begin there and say, you know, Wilhelm Reich. Well, actually, no, that would be getting ahead of story. I think we need to set the stage a little bit more. So, Kevin Hinchey, I'm going to begin with you. When you try to explain to somebody, maybe somebody who walks in the door on a beautiful summer day up in Rangeley into your museum without much understanding of who this guy is, and they say, whose museum am I in right now? What do you say to them?
Some of them who come in probably have some sort of vague knowledge, having read something locally coming in. But in answer to your question, I like to start really at the end, pretty much the way you did just now, and explain that this was a psychoanalyst, a psychiatrist, a research physician, and a scientist whose books were banned and burned by order of federal court in America in the 1950s. And that what you really want to do is sort of explain what was it in Reich's publications, 10 hardcover books, 11 years of his published research journals that allegedly merited this literature being banned and burned. So we always find whether people are walking into a museum or people are coming into conferences or just in terms of normal conversations, That always seems to be a wonderful way to pull people in, because in the end, whether they're particularly – they end up being particularly interested in his life and work, the idea of a man's books being banned and burned in America during his lifetime and 3 years after his death really arouses their curiosity and makes them a little more susceptible or receptive to the story.
You know, James Strick, regardless of whether a person buys into any of Reich's ideas or not, and we'll come to that, but whether you do or not, studying him is studying this incredible history of the fusion of the behavioral sciences and the medical sciences and the politics of Middle Europe in the 1930s and 1940s. He's racing all over Middle and Northern Europe. He's using ideas from Marxism to fuel some of his scientific thinking. He's using... he's part of this revolution of sexual research that's going on in the 1930s. We've seen a little bit of that being chronicled even now in popular culture these days on the TV series Transparent. You see actually Magnus Hirschfeld, another sexual researcher whose books were also burned after doing a lot of research in the liberal Weimar years. And certainly Reich's shadow is hanging over this Showtime series, Masters of Sex. I don't know if he's been mentioned yet, but he's certainly is it's so much a series about the difficulties in the 1950s in America of doing sexual research, how much trouble you could get into no matter how scientific you tried to be. So it's all over the place there. And I guess one thing I was going to ask you, James Strick, is as you looked at all this, what drew you to Reich? He's not an easy guy to sell to a canonical scientific audience. What made you want to write about him?
Yeah, well, it's worth saying a little bit about my background and what my general research is about in order to make it clear. I'm a historian of science by training. Like about half of historians of science, I was originally a scientist, in my case a microbiologist. And when I retrained as a historian of science, the kind of stories that I was most interested in looking into were ideas and experiments about the origin of life. My first book, for example, is Darwin and his chief lieutenants arguing amongst themselves for the first 20 years after the origin of species. What does this theory mean about the origin of the first living thing on Earth? So when I heard about a story of a Freudian psychoanalyst who ended up in a physiology laboratory and sort of serendipitously stumbled into origin of life experiments, it piqued my curiosity for a dozen different reasons. I mean, one wanted to know right away, what's a Freudian psychoanalyst doing in a physiology laboratory? How does he possibly end up in the middle of origin of life experiments? And the more I looked into it and discovered the man's books were burned under official orders by an agency of the U.S. government, you really want to know, what's in those books? What is this guy's research program all about? What made it an interesting story to research and write about, I think not just for historians of science, but for a much broader audience, is that, as you say, it's a window into an awful lot of science and politics in the interwar period in Europe. I end my book, Wilhelm Reich, Biologist, right at the point in August 1939 when Reich takes ship and comes to the United States, escaping Europe essentially, you know, just ahead of the outbreak of World War II. And the eyewitness view that it gives you into not just politics, not just science, but how politics was so interfering with science in Europe in the 1920s and 30s, I think is really an extraordinary case study. Then, too, the experiments that I referred to where Reich found himself in Origin of Life unexpectedly are the experiments that led him directly to a very unorthodox theory of how cancer cells develop. And the same experiments led him to discover what he considered to be a previously unknown form of radiation that on further investigation he decided the evidence suggested was a specific biological energy that some biologists had hypothesized and been looking for some years. So since both his theory of what he called orgone energy and his theory of the origin of cancer cells are intimately related to what eventually led to his confrontation with the United States government in the late 1940s and 1950s, it seemed to me like this story would be interesting for an even more important reason. Anybody who was ever interested in whether whether there was any substance to his science, in contradistinction to the widespread narrative that once Reich went into the laboratory, nothing but pseudoscience resulted, would want to know about these experiments because they were foundational to the issues that led him into conflict with the U.S. government.
Let me grab a call here. By the way, our number is 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. We're live here during the afternoon, and you may also tweet us at WNPRColin. Here's Philip in Hamden with a question. Hi, Philip.
Hi. I've done a little bit of reading about Reich, and what I've been struck with is it seems that when I read him versus what's said, there's such a gross misunderstanding of his work. So I'm wondering if you could invite your guest to try to explain or give their opinions as to why they think Reich is so, you know, dramatically misunderstood.
All right. It's sort of the $10 million question in some ways. And Kevin, it's a question with a lot of long answers. But is there a short answer? Why was this guy demonized? As James Strick is saying, some of the work that he was doing, certainly in that kind of interwar period, as he calls it, and as he kind of departed psychoanalysis and began to go into the lab, was sort of at the level of pure research. But it freaked people out and pissed people off. But in general, that's the story of Reich. You know, wherever he goes, he's getting on people's nerves and he's getting demonized. So what's the reason?
Well, no, and you're right. That is the major question, and I appreciate the listener's question there. If you start to look at the distortions about Reich, which persist to this day, they actually originate early on during his early years as one of Freud's most promising students. He was a psychoanalyst. He was also a neuropsychiatrist. And it's a number of things. It could be conceptual differences because he was looking into more innovative therapeutic techniques. He was also a very gifted young clinician. There were professional animosities and jealousies and things like that. And also because he became heavily involved at a certain point, really from 1927 on, a very outspoken individual involved in left-wing politics, speaking out against the rise of fascism in both Austria and then in Germany, where he moves to. And so a lot of these animosities and distortions begin back then. They incubate, they persist, and they seem to follow him wherever they go. Professor Strick alluded to sort of this mix of politics and science. And in terms of what ultimately happens to him here in America, many of these distortions, many of these animosities precede him to America by colleagues of his or former colleagues of his who have emigrated to America in the 1930s prior to his arrival. So when Reich arrives here, and he arrives on August 28th, 4 days before the outbreak of the war, there are already severe animosities and distortions about him that are permeating the psychoanalytic, the psychiatric, and the medical professions here in America.
I'm just going to stay with you for a second here, Kevin. And there are like 4 or 5 phases at minimum to Reich's career, to his research, to the things he was interested in. And we probably won't have time to cover them all today. But, you know, the story begins, and I'm of necessity going to oversimplify, mm-hmm. A, for the sake of time, and B, because I don't know the more nuanced version of this. But, you know, one of the ways in which he begins to confront his master, Sigmund Freud, with a slightly different version of things is, in fact, this notion of sexual release, which he sees as a much bigger thing, a thing that's a that's holistic, that's kind of the energistic and psychic version of what like a colon cleanse is today or something, that there's some way in which this is energy that can be harnessed to flush all kinds of things out of a patient. And he's with this in as Freud starts turning away from the libido and more towards ego psychiatry, and he's with it in a way that seems to rattle even Freud a little bit.
Well, I think that's accurate. But what's important to remember is there was a period of time, and it went on for several decades, where Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, actually believed that the libido was not just an idea, but that it could possibly be a physical, biological energy that could be measured. And Reich hooked on to this, but he was not the only psychoanalysis and psychiatrist who was interested in this. Now, at a certain point, Reich sort of turned away from that idea of his. But based on his clinical work with patients, and Reich was always considered, even by people who eventually became his detractors, to be one of the most gifted psychoanalytic and psychiatric clinicians. Based on his work with patients from all different kinds of backgrounds, private patients, patients of his from the proletarian classes, patients he was working with in various clinics and things like that, he was convinced that the libido was in fact a real energy because that's how strong it was. And so it's interesting that he is really just taking a concept that Freud himself advocated for many years and really sticking with it based on clinical research with real patients. But, you know, as you said, Colin, it is one of the things that did begin to cause some enmity between him and Freud, because if you follow it to its logical conclusion, and even Freud would say that neuroses are based on sexual repression. That's not Reich's idea. That's Freud's idea. But if you follow it to its logical conclusion, it has social implications, because you have to consider what is causing these neuroses, what is causing the sexual repression. And when Reich becomes politically active, he's really coming out and saying we need to change certain social institutions. And that's where you really start to see the larger break happen between him and Freud, because of the social implications of this.
Right. He's also working on this whole idea of I love it. It's called sort of a body armor, but he calls it Charakterpanzer. And you know, this notion that we're holding tensions in our bodies. And we'll talk about this a little bit in the third segment. This is certainly an idea that survived in lots of modified forms into a very, very acceptable way of thinking about things in the United States. There was a guy in the 1970s named Alexander Lowen who made a fortune writing books about this. They were bestseller books. They were just purely based on Reich's ideas.
And yes, he had been a student of Freud's.
Right.
Of Reich's.
And
yes.
To this day, if you hang around some yoga studios, you're going to hear some ideas that sound an awful lot like Charakterpanzer, this notion that our bodies begin to defend themselves against psychic trauma, and that we hold these tensions in there. So not all of it's kind of crazy talk, not at all. And so James Strick, so much of what he did seemed to be what other people were doing. He was a sexual researcher in the Weimar years, when a lot of people were sexual researchers. He was an avid Marxist at a time when a lot of people were avid Marxists. He was a guy who thought you could combine ideas of Marxist dialectical materialism with an approach to scientific research at a time when a lot of people were doing that. So once again, what gets him in trouble? Why? How come he's the guy getting chased out of everywhere, getting chased out of Norway, getting chased out of, why is he in so much trouble compared to everybody else?
It's interesting that you focus first, Colin, on the distinction that he made compared to many of the other psychoanalysts about how really gratifying sexual experience could, in fact, relieve people's neurotic symptoms. he saw this in his patients, in his private patients. He also saw it in his patients at the free clinics that the Freudians staffed for the working class. And when he first told his psychoanalytic colleagues about this, and I think this goes back to addressing the question, too, why is it so widespread that Reich is misunderstood? The very foundational approach conceptually that he took to this is nuanced, and a lot of people don't read Reich. They only read quick thumbnail sketches on the internet, and they miss the important nuance that makes this thing hang together. Reich, when he first presented this idea to his psychoanalytic colleagues and said, look, you know, the patients I have who are severely neurotic, when they actually experience genuine sexual gratification, they get better. Their symptoms diminish dramatically. And his colleagues were, for the most part, pretty skeptical. They said, come on, I've got lots of patients who have sex all the time, and they're still severely neurotic. And that prompted Reich to ask his patients in much closer detail about their sex lives. And what he discovered was that the vast majority of his colleagues were just asking their patients, you know, do you have sex? Or how often do you have sex? And that, to them, was satisfactory data for passing judgment on these ideas. But when he asked his patients in much greater detail about their sex lives, he found that it was, in a way, you know, we all instinctively understand this, right? It wasn't about quantity. And I think the single most common misunderstanding or misapprehension or misrepresentation of Reich is that he claimed that if you just had sex all the time, it would cure everything from neurosis to cancer. And Reich was, in fact, the person who discovered that it wasn't just about quantity. He framed this in a concept that he called orgastic potency. He said, what I've really found here is that if the patient has the internal capability to let go and really allow themselves a completely gratifying sexual experience, that's what leads to diminishment of neurotic symptoms. And he was the first one to notice that it was the patients who couldn't do that who frequently became hypersexualized because they couldn't get gratification and therefore were running around screwing all over the place. And I think very few people who read Reich or who read about Reich really understand that concept of orgastic potency, that for Reich, it was not just having sex. It was the ability to experience complete discharge of the dammed up energy that meant the energy was no longer there to fuel the neurotic symptoms. And that's what he called orgastic potency. And it's important not just because it's foundational for everything that Reich did afterwards. If you really don't take this concept on board, I think it'll be very hard for you to understand or take seriously most of what Reich did, because this concept is central to everything that he did afterwards. But it's also a key piece of what helps you understand why he felt moved to take this into the laboratory. I mean, he was not trained as a physiologist. He had a medical degree, and he had, of course, some laboratory science background in his medical training. But he felt that, and he wasn't the only psychoanalyst who felt this way, if we can't take Freud's libido theory into the laboratory and show that you can really demonstrate that libido is actually a tangible, measurable force that we could study quantitatively, and we could show that in patients whose neurotic symptoms are diminishing, there's more of it freely available that we can measure, and in patients in whose neurotic symptoms are still very severe, it's bound in a way that it is not freely available for work and other productive activities in life. That's why he felt so compelled to go into a physiology laboratory to explore this further, was because
actually I'm going to interrupt
he really
you.
Felt it was I'm going to interrupt the key you there just source of energy.
James Strick, I've got to go to a break here, and I want to get us into that laboratory, and we've already used up half the show, and there's so many things that we've got to talk about here. So I'm going to grab a break here. We'll come back. We'll talk more to Kevin Hinchey and to James Strick.
All right, then, come on, spin.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you.
Let's talk All right, we're back. We're talking about the legacy of Wilhelm Reich, the complicated legacy of Wilhelm Reich with two people who believe that he has been misunderstood over time. Kevin Hinchey is the co-director of the Wilhelm Reich Infant Trust and operates the Wilhelm Reich Museum in Rangeley, Maine. It's way, way up there among some beautiful lakes. He's also a screenwriter currently working on a documentary on Wilhelm Reich. And James Strick is with us, professor and chair of the Department of Science, Technology, and Society, professor of Earth and Environment, Franklin and Marshall College. He's the author of Wilhelm Reich, Biologist. So, James Strick, I just want to come back to what you were saying before, because this is the meat of your book, really, is this time in which Reich turns away, really, from the bones of psychoanalysis and gets into the bare bones of life. He really becomes interested in maybe even trying to understand life at its cellular level and what might even be a theory of the origin of life. And he winds up talking about something that he calls a bion. Now, this is something, obviously, that you've written a very long book about, and our time is much shorter. But can you give us kind of a thumbnail of what he's talking about? What is he talking about with the bion?
Yeah, so in some ways, it is in the tradition of some other work that was going on in the 1920s and 30s called cell model experiments, where people were trying to imitate the properties of very, very simple cells by putting together different combinations of chemicals that would produce, you know, microscopic structures that had some of the properties of cellular life but not all, and trying by this approach to understand, well, what might a chemical origin of life have been like? But Reich was also pursuing a second track of experiments. He was watching already organized matter, you know, dead grass or moss or dead animal tissue, disintegrate in broth under the microscope. And he found that in both cases he saw very similar kinds of microscopic structures produced that had really similar properties. These are the things he called bions. They were very small, about the size of a bacterial cell. But they had properties like electrical charge that was characteristic of a living system, and they could, under certain circumstances, be grown in culture generation after generation. So once the preparation was made, you could transfer it to sterile culture media, and a culture of these exact same bions, a pure culture of just this one kind of microbe, would grow up in that sterile medium. And if you took a sample of that and transferred it again to another sterile medium, it would grow up again through many generations. And Reich began to think these things must be at least transitional stages between non-living and living matter if they had so many properties that were lifelike. But by the time he starts to be able to grow them in culture through successive generations, he's asking himself, are these things alive? Have I stumbled here on processes by which life is created in nature out of non-living material? And he's kind of going back and forth between those two hypotheses at different points in the experiments. But the bions are, as I said earlier, important not just whether you take them seriously as experiments that had something to say about the origin of life based on where laboratory research was in the 1930s. They're also important because Reich thought when he saw a parallel process of disintegration into bions in animal tissue under certain circumstances, especially if it was depleted of energy or oxygen starved, and then those bions reorganized themselves into protozoa that looked almost identical to cancer cells taken in a living state from cancer patients, he began to think that these bions were a lot more important than just about the bridge between life and non-life, that it might be the disintegration of tissue inside the body of a living organism into these bions that created cancer cells.
All right, we're going to
have the unorthodox theory that I spoke about earlier.
Right, we need to pause that here. We're just going to run out of time, and it would be nice to build kind of an immaculate set of bridges from one thing to another, but I think that's going to be tough to do. Kevin Hinchey, and I should say, by the way, we're going to embed on our website a link to the Indiegogo campaign to raise funds for the Wilhelm Reich documentary film project. That's what Kevin's working on right here. That campaign runs until next Friday, May 20th. But so eventually, He's trying to do these experiments in Norway. Europe is basically collapsing around him. He gets out pretty much on metaphorically the last bus, winds up in the United States. There's a lot of things to talk about there. But, I mean, we're going to just have to kind of leapfrog ahead. The thing he becomes famous for next is, in fact, this orgone energy accumulator. So sometimes called the orgone box. And once again, Kevin, I'll have you in a thumbnail or a nutshell lay that one out for us.
Yeah, okay. And just go back very briefly to what Professor Strick said. These experiments with bions, 1936, 1937, 1938 in his laboratory in Oslo. And then in early 1939, he finds in a particular bion culture, a specific bion culture, a radiation phenomenon. And it is after discovering this radiation phenomenon that he starts using Faraday cages to really help determine, is this electricity? He uses other experiments. Is this radioactivity? You know, what is this? And he determines that this is an energy in and of itself that is previously undiscovered, and he gives it the name of orgone energy. And when he comes to the United States, and it's just a few months after his discovery of this orgone energy in microscopic cultures in January and February of 1939, comes to America at the end of August, and war breaks out a few days later, he immediately sets up a laboratory in the house that he's renting in Forest Hills to continue what he calls orgone energy research. And these Faraday cages, which are metal enclosures, mesh screen or solid screen, eventually, based on his observations, will evolve with certain different layering into what he would call orgone energy accumulators, which would isolate and hold in the radiation from these various cultures he's experimenting with. And then he also discovers later on in the Rangeley Lakes area, about a year later in July 1940, that this same energy as a biological energy in these cultures, he also discovers in the atmosphere. And so he discovers that these now orgone energy accumulators can also absorb and concentrate an atmospheric orgone energy. And at the time, these are just small accumulators, about 1 cubic foot. Eventually, he will do experiments with cancer mice in these small orgone accumulators. The results are rather promising. And again, these are based on his bion experiments, you know, back in Oslo. And because the results with cancer mice using these small orgone accumulators are so promising, he eventually develops larger accumulators, large enough for a person to sit in. And in early 1941, he will embark on the first of his experimental cancer treatments with individuals with terminal cancer.
So this is one of the places he gets into trouble. So a lot of things are happening right now. We're talking about a period in the late 40s, early 50s. America was, on the one hand, incredibly distrustful of outside influences, new ideas, anybody with a Marxist past. We're talking about what is sometimes referred to as the Second Red Scare. That's going on. But there's also this incredible countercultural movement. So Reich winds up, Kevin, with a profile in both places, right? He's, on the one hand, being excoriated by one journalist in particular, a woman named Mildred Brady, writing a series of articles about him in both the New Republic and Harper's, that he's the leader of a new cult of sex and anarchy. He's a dangerous man. He's using these devices. People don't know what they are. On the other hand, he gradually gets a tremendous amount of traction that lasts for really decades with people like Norman Mailer, J.D. Salinger, Saul Bellow, Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, Dwight MacDonald, William S. Burroughs. You can go all the way into the 70s, and supposedly Sean Connery is still using some version of the orgone energy accumulator. So if Sean Connery is using it, we all ought to as well. So both of these things are happening at once, but maybe we can talk about the first thing. He becomes an outlaw to a certain degree. I mean, these articles are written about him, and the government gets very interested in a very negative way in the work of Reich.
Right. Well, you can't really separate the two threads that you've elaborated on there. And so, for example, this is where we start coming to the major distortions about the Orgone Energy Accumulator, which starts to be used by people starting in 1941. And the two major distortions about this are, number one, that Reich was promoting it as a cancer cure, and he was doing nothing of the kind. I often say to people, I will wager you any amount of money at any time if you can find anything in Reich's publications where he claims he can cure cancer, whereas I could show you five or six statements where he can't. So that's the other one. In terms of all the names that you mentioned there, these writers and things like that, yes, they were admirers of Reich, but they in fact do a great disservice to Reich because individuals like them seem to misinterpret what the Orgone Accumulator was about, and they are partially responsible. People like Burroughs and Kerouac and even earlier people, Bellow, that this somehow was some sort of sexual device to enhance potency, to make you have a more gratifying sexual life. That is not the case, and Reich never made those claims for it.
So if it's not a sex box and it's not a cure cancer box, what is it?
It is an experimental, scientific, and medical tool, and let's go to the medical tool first. Reich was experimenting with cancer patients, and yes, he did get promising results by people using the Orgone Accumulator. Promising results. That didn't mean it was cancer. And Reich published all of these results in various case histories, which he compiled into a book in 1948 called The Cancer Biopathy. But it also started to get this reputation. This is some sort of, it's a cancer cure, it's a sex box, it's this, that. And Mildred Brady, who you referenced, who was a freelance writer, is really one of the first to put these kinds of distortions, to really put them in a concise form in an article in May of 1947 in New Republic magazine, in which she essentially calls upon the authorities, whether it's psychoanalytic authorities or others, because that was what his background is, to really look into this man. And she is the one who first puts into print, perhaps what other people were thinking, but she puts into print that the Orgone Accumulator can be used to enhance orgastic potency. And then she also talks about some of his, in a more basic way, about his cancer research. This article comes to the attention somehow of a physician who is on a medical advisory board of the Federal Trade Commission, which oversees various consumer things. And when he reads that Reich is in fact renting out these Orgone Accumulators so patients can use them at home, which Reich thought would be a wonderful way for people to, you know, really come up with new information about these devices, this doctor at the Federal Trade Commission passes this article on to someone at the Food and Drug Administration and basically says, this is something you might want to look into.
Okay, I'm going to pause you right there because I just, once again, I'm fighting a clock here. The show's like almost over at this point. So, James Strick, we live in an era where there's a very, very determined approach to divide things up between science and pseudoscience. Reich is always put in the category of pseudoscience. Whenever we do a show about anything that could be described as woo-woo, I know certain columns and magazines I'm going to wind up in. Here's McEnroe again parading pseudoscience around. But you got Harvard University Press to publish a book about Reich. How did you do that? What was the basis for doing it? Why was Harvard University Press willing to publish a book on Reich, given the fact that he died in prison for reasons that Kevin is already setting up? This is a guy who's been reviled in a lot of ways as a pseudoscientist. Most of the ideas we're talking about are not even remotely canonical. So first of all, why write a book about him? And how did you get Harvard to publish it?
Let me just say one thing before taking on your question directly. The business about Reich claiming the Orgone Energy Accumulator was a cancer cure, that's one of the most direct ways to find out whether anybody has ever actually read anything by Reich. Because his book, The Cancer Biopathy, where he describes the experiments that he did on human cancer patients, reports very straightforwardly that every single one of the patients died. Every single one of the patients that came to him as a last-ditch patient who had been declared hopeless, etc., and was willing to try his experimental therapy because they had no other options left, all of them died, and Reich is very clear about that. Now, how one can take that and read it as Reich claiming that the orgone energy accumulator is a cure for cancer, I think it can only pass if somebody hasn't ever bothered to read Reich. The Food and Drug Administration, when they successfully prosecuted Reich, declared that he made those claims, but they declared it based on Brady's articles, not based on anything that Reich ever put into print himself. So, you know, but once the Food and Drug Administration declares that that was what Reich said, and Reich is the loser, so they're going to get a lot more publicity for their side of the story than he is, the dominant narrative becomes that Reich was a pseudoscientist and that this was a claimed cancer cure that was bogus. How do you ever overcome a dominant narrative?
I've got to jump in here because we are going to be out of time in the end of the final segment here. So we're going to jump in here. We're going to take a break. We'll come back with more of this conversation.
Judge says that's exactly what you get. He did 10 years in Attica, reading Nietzsche and Wilhelm Reich.
Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Stephanie Reif and Ross Levin, whose final day is today. Thank you so much for your help, Ross. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Anna Freud. For show pages, news, and videos of the entire Here and Now staff packed into one orgone box, go to our website, wnpr.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, the nose goes to the movies. And now, back to Colin.
I still dream of Organon. I wake up crying. You're making rain, and you're just in reach. When you in sleep escape me, you're like my yo-yo. I glowed in the dark. What made it special? Needed dangerous.
All right, Kevin Hinchy. That's a song called Cloudbusters by Kate Bush. It's about yet another phase of Wilhelm Reich. As he's getting a little bit towards the end of his life and some of the recriminations against him are piling up, he maybe gets a little bit more eccentric, and he does have this idea of the Cloudbuster, which some people describe as an inside-out orgone. I should say musically, there's all kinds of stuff. It's another way that he's celebrated in culture. Those of you who are still lamenting the death of the famous bassist Lemmy should check out the Hawkwind sound song called Orgone Accumulator. There's a Patti Smith song that's based on Peter Reich, Wilhelm's son, and the two of them having a reunion in a UFO or something. So Cloudbusters really refers to a thing that Reich was trying to do. Explain that one for us.
Yeah, and the Cloudbuster, it doesn't have anything to do with the orgone accumulator except that some of the energetic principles are the same. But these were experiments that Reich was doing starting in 1952, and they grew out of some atmospheric work he was doing, and he actually created a instrument called a Cloudbuster, which would grounded in water could affect the energy, the orgone energy potential in the atmosphere. And as with all of his work, as Professor Strick would attest to, is we have decades of Reich's notebooks, and in addition to his published work. And in fact, there are numerous documented cases of successful experiments where he was able to alter the orgone energy potential in the atmosphere and bring about increased moisture and in some cases even rain. And that goes from around 1952 to 1956, and then Reich gets absorbed with all kinds of legal difficulties. So about 4 years.
Yeah. So there may be a little bit of a post hoc Proctor hoc question here about that, but he did at least persuade some blueberry farmers that he could that he could literally make it rain, as they say.
And so, I interviewed one of them for the documentary film, or the son of one of them who was there when it happened. Yeah.
So, James Strick, at this point, though, we really are beginning to get, I mean, if in fact Reich wasn't out on a limb with some of his other stuff, he's getting further out on a limb here. Some of it may be the product of the persecution that he's been going through, and he does get interested in UFOs. I mean, there seems to be a certain point, some people might say it starts way earlier than what we're talking about, when Reich becomes his own worst enemy.
Well, people have expressed a lot of opinions about that, and unfortunately, most of them seem to be pure opinion. I mean, just about everybody that you talk to who knows something about Reich is absolutely certain that he went crazy at some point. And when you ask them when it is, it's always the point at which he started to come up with ideas that they didn't like anymore. The psychoanalysts were sure that the time that when he went crazy was either when he became a Marxist, or if they were left-wing psychoanalysts, some of them, when he went into a laboratory. It's hard to judge Reich's sanity at the remove that we're at. I think that one of the reasons why Harvard University Press, to go back to your earlier question, was interested in publishing the book that I was suggesting was that I said, rather than base any of this on opinion, it's a really exciting possibility since Reich's archives have opened to scholars since the fall of 2007. Why don't I go in there and look at his laboratory notebooks, at least on the set of microbiology experiments that I'm sure I'll understand the best because of my microbiology training? And why don't I try to form an opinion based on what's going on day to day in his laboratory as recorded in those notebooks about whether this really was pseudoscience or not? It's not hard to tell if notebooks look fabricated. And the notebooks that I found pretty much correspond day by day with the sequence of development of the experiments that Reich later reported in his published reports. So I think, one of the main conclusions of my book is that one could disagree with Reich about how to interpret what he saw in his experiments. I think rational people could offer possibly alternative interpretations, especially based on new scientific ideas in biology. But we can dismiss this narrative of pseudoscience and say at least that's a fruitless discussion. Now it would probably be a lot more fruitful discussion to focus on, well, what do these things mean? From the laboratory notebooks that he saw what he says he saw, now let's have an interesting discussion about what it actually means.
We are almost out of time here. So, Kevin, one thing that we didn't do today, just because he wasn't available, was talk to Christopher Turner, who has written a biography of Reich that is less laudatory than anything that you are probably going to make in your film or what James Strick would write in his book, and making the argument that really Reich, was a pretty screwed up guy. That his daughter, a psychoanalyst herself, psychotherapist herself, said that she thought he was sexually abused as a child. That led to some of his disorders. That other people, like Ernest Jones, thought he was mentally ill. That he had a turbulent life that caused him a lot of his problems. Had affairs with some of his patients and very turbulent marriages and relationships. So, I mean, how much of that's fair? A lot of the attacks on Reich are there was something wrong with this guy, and there was something wrong with this guy from Jump Street.
I think a lot of this is unfair. I had years ago considerable contact with Christopher Turner. I won't say too much. I think he proceeded in a lot of dishonest ways in talking to people and sort of disguising his agenda. And the fact that he would publish a book called Adventures in the Orgasmatron, I think pretty much tells you everything about his agenda. And so I think it's always been unfair for people to really go through and cherry pick all these various things. I think you could probably do that with any number of people. So that's about all I want to say about that.
All right. Well, that's good because that's all we have time for. So obviously good luck with the biography. And if people are traveling in northern Maine this summer, they might want to stop at the Wilhelm Reich Museum in Rangeley, Maine, up there by the lakes. As I say, the Indiegogo link for the documentary will be up on our website as part of this show page. Thanks to everybody who helped out today. And certainly thanks to James Strick, author of Wilhelm Reich, biologist, and Kevin Hinchey, who's doing this bio documentary of Reich. And thanks to Betsy Kaplan for producing. And I think this is the Hawkwind tune, right?
So you put it.
Yeah.
And then you push.
Yep.
And then you pull.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's all about?
Yep. The hokey pokey has always been what it's all about.
Is that what they call it?
No.